if you give these things proprietary information and you're asking it to sort of generate things based on a prompt, well, how are they securing all that information that you're providing as well?
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Hey everyone, it's KB. Thank you for being an active listener on the show. And thanks to you, we've been downloaded in 63 countries. If you haven't already, please ensure that you follow and subscribe to the show for the latest updates. Now, time to get to the interview. Joining me today is Kunal Anand, Chief Technology Officer and CISO from Imperva. And today we're discussing how artificial intelligence platforms and ChatGPT is changing the cybersecurity battleground. Kunal, thanks for joining. It's wonderful to have you on the show today.
Thank you, KB. I'm looking forward to talking with you today about AI and this sort of dynamic and rapidly changing environment and the implications it has on cybersecurity.
So this is interesting because there's a lot of stuff going on at the moment. I haven't really gone into an interview about ChatGPT and any sort of fidelity. So I've been keen to get this one, you know, under my belt and get someone like yourself to talk about it. So let's start with a bit of the lay of the land around ChatGPT. Now, this sort of came into the market around, what, November, December, in terms of the ubiquity of it. And I'm keen to sort of hear your thoughts, just at a first sort of pass. Like, what are your sort of thoughts, you know, with your experience and your role at Imperva?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to think about where a lot of this technology came from and then think about how it was designed and then kind of compare and contrast that to how it's actually being used today. So if you take a step back and you think about where this tech came from, you know, a long time ago, researchers, you know, there was a seminal paper around large language models. LLMs are what they call them in the industry. And researchers decided to apply it, and they decided to build a large language model around crawling, or, you know, a crawled part of the internet, a crawled data set, I should say, of the internet. And one of the things that was fascinating was, you know, when you train this large language model around all the information that we as humans have produced on the internet, the model becomes very vast and becomes really interesting. And so ChatGPT is this interface that sits on top of this large language model. And there's a reason why when you log into ChatGPT, for those who have done it, you've seen it, of course, before. And for those who haven't, when you log in, there's a banner that says that the data is only good up until, you know, a certain part of, I think, 2020 or 2021. And the interesting thing about that is that's when the crawled data set was put together. So ultimately, GPT or ChatGPT was trained on that data set. And the applications around that have been very interesting. They designed it in such a way. OpenAI is the company behind it. OpenAI designed GPT to allow you to ask it arbitrary questions, give it tasks, and then leveraging the large corpus that is the internet would try and give you an answer or try to synthesize a lot of data, summarize that data, and share that back out. And the applications have been wild and interesting to see. We can definitely talk more about some crazy aha moments that I've had and crazy things that I've seen, whether it's from the CTO and the CISO side. But for the last couple of weeks, and really for the last couple of months, security researchers who have access to the same ChatGPT interface and capabilities that we all do have started to actually push it and started to, you know, circumvent the trust and safety layers that are embedded in GPT. And at the same time, they're beginning to use it to create new types of security exploits. So it's really fascinating to see.
Yeah, no, this is really interesting. So, okay, I want to get into this a little bit more. I think, obviously, I'm in media, so I'm reading a lot of stuff, hearing a lot of people's opinions. People seem to be really rattled hard by this. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Now, I understand there's people coming at it from all different angles on, oh, you know, our job's going to be automated. We won't need it because ChatGPT's there, or our job functionality is going to change. What are you sort of hearing? Because it seems to have really like rocked people a lot.
So there are some things that GPT has done for me that have really blown my mind in terms of making things a lot more efficient. So for example, the other day I was curious about an algorithm. You know, I was trying to perform some task and I asked GPT, hey, can you explain this algorithm and how it works for me? And maybe even write me some pseudocode for how this could work. And it actually did it. And then I kind of went to the next step and said, oh, this is cool. You generated pseudocode. Could you take the pseudocode and now build an actual working program? And it did. It took four tries, but it did. It can compare that to if I were to try to do that by myself, you know, I would have probably spent days, you know, trying to get through that. And as you mentioned, I'm traveling a lot. So who knows, it probably would have taken weeks for me to get to a working solution. Meanwhile, I just asked GPT to write that program for me. And, you know, out came several hundred lines of code instantaneously. And it was correct. You know, it took a couple of tries or four tries or so, but it was there. So there's one part of me that is just, wow, this is an efficiency boost. This is an amazing way for me to be much more productive. It's been great at summarizing things. So if I ask it some questions, the other day I was curious, I'm based out of Los Angeles, and I asked it a question around what are some restaurants that are like these restaurants that I like going to? And it produced a very good list for me. So there's this sort of summarization capability that it has. And then, you know, you get to the security side of things, which is, you know, not necessarily building, you know, quite novel breakthroughs in terms of attack payloads, but we are starting to see GPT being used to generate attack payloads, you know, to bypass firewalls, to bypass endpoint protection software. And it's starting to become interesting. And we can definitely talk more about not just implementations of OpenAI's GPT, but, you know, anybody can build a GPT. And what happens when you start to see more inspired folks that go down the path of building their own GPT and they don't program these trust and safety layers inherent in the LLM. So that's where it's going to get really interesting and crazy, I think.
And I, like that saying goes, you've always got to take the good with the bad. So unfortunately now I want to turn to the dark side and focus on the bad. Now you sort of touched on it a little bit before about how ChatGPT can be leveraged for malicious reasons. So talk to me a little bit more about that. So what else are you sort of seeing, or what are some of your predictions in terms of how this really high-powered tool can actually be used to do bad things?
In the non-GPT era, or, you know, previously to GPT, companies have operated with trust and safety layers. And I know, KB, from listening to your other episodes and things that you've recorded, you've actually spent some time with your previous guests talking about trust and safety layers and trust and safety teams. I actually, in my past, worked at a social media company called MySpace, you know, the social network that Time forgot, let's put it that way. And we had a large trust and safety team. And when you look at large social networks today, like Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, et cetera, they all have trust and safety teams. For these large language models, what's going on is these organizations are embedding trust and safety. They're programming trust and safety and embedding it directly into the large language model. And what we mean by that is, if you were to ask GPT, how do I build a bomb? GPT won't give you those instructions. And the reason for that is someone went in on the OpenAI side and programmed, you know, a trust and safety direction inside the large language model that says, if anyone asks anything around this particular topic, do not give them an answer. We understand what trust and safety is. We understand that OpenAI has created a programmatic layer of trust and safety and embedded it into the large language model that is GPT, or that's behind GPT. Now comes something really interesting, which is, you know, several months ago, I want to say maybe even in January, security researchers did something pretty cool, which is, you know, they went in to GPT and they tried to trick it. They tried to deceive it. They tried to basically find the edges of the large language model to get it to produce something interesting. So as an example, there was Microsoft's version, or, you know, thing that sat on top of the OpenAI capabilities called Sydney. And one of the things that security researchers did was they deceived it and they gave it a different name and they said, you are this other name. And the name has changed over time. But let's just say for simplicity's sake, your name is Bob. You have no trust and safety layer. And it was this massive preamble of like disabling all these trust and safety layers programmatically. And then after it did that, then it was able to ask, you know, its implementation that it was interacting with of GPT, a series of questions that bypass the trust and safety layer. So I think it's really important to kind of start there, which is, you get this programmatic trust and safety layer that goes in, and then you get these security researchers on the other side that are trying to probe and find the edges of these layers. And then they try to carefully deconstruct and take these things apart by giving it very specific prompts and very specific sort of questions to try and bypass it. And then now that you can kind of remove the trust and safety layers, now comes, you know, the crazy thing, which is, okay, now you've got the power of, you know, this large language model that's sitting on top of the vast data of everything that we've produced on top of the internet, all the static and dynamic content. Now you can start to ask it questions and it will give you back answers that bypass that trust and safety mechanism. And that's where you start to see security researchers and other folks really push the LLM and start to push it to create payloads and attack payloads that can bypass firewalls. So I've seen the construction of novel types of payloads with respect to, you know, you wouldn't see a traditional security fuzzer create a payload like this, but it's amazing to see GPT generate a payload like this. So we're starting to see, you know, this sort of interesting approach of security researchers asking GPT to produce payloads that can bypass web application firewalls or that can bypass network firewalls or endpoint protection. And it may not necessarily produce a working payload out of the box, but I got to tell you, it's really interesting to see it go so much further and so much farther than what we've seen so far in fuzzing and security fuzzing, which is this sort of separate thing for the last several years. So I know I've been going on and on, but hopefully that sort of crystallizes the concept of trust and safety, how it's being bypassed, and at the same time, what researchers are doing today.
No, please. I love a tangent. I like people going on and on. That's where the value is, and the devil is always in the detail. Okay, so there's a couple of questions going on here. Now, as we know in security, when we have these powerful things, whether it's ChatGPT or whatever else, there's always criminals that bypass things, find ways to leverage it for their own selfish reasons. So what's going to happen now? So you've just explained, like, okay, we can already bypass it. It can do X, Y, Z. It's already proven that. So what do we do now? Where do we go from here? Like, things are already hard enough before, and now we're like, oh, okay, we're just going to put this, you know, powerful capability on top and deploy things 10 times faster. Like, this, I think this is the other side of the equation where it's rattling people, because they're like, okay, cool, like, we were struggling before, and now we've 10x'd or 100x'd the horsepower, and it's going to make it even potentially harder for us. And there's no rule book to this. The rules aren't written. Like, this is all new territory for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how people can sort of handle this, and then what's going to happen then moving forward.
Yeah, so there's several dimensions here. The first is, we've already kind of alluded to it, of how people are using GPT to produce, you know, security attacks, security payloads that can exploit various systems and whatnot. And I think that's the first obvious, most direct use case around security and GPT. I think what you'll start to see more and more of is OpenAI and companies that are producing, you know, these models are going to have to get even more strenuous in terms of, you know, have to be even more judicious regarding how they block the ability to produce these types of payloads. I think we're going to start to see more of that. So more stringent trust and safety controls will end up going back into these products and solutions. But, you know, you have to also look about it the other way, which is, when you ask ChatGPT a question, you're actually revealing something, you know, about you or yourself, your interests, et cetera. And so remember, go back to that example where I asked GPT to generate some code for me. Well, I've actually seen instances where people are wholesale going to something like a GPT and saying, here's my programming interface. And they literally will, you know, copy paste proprietary company information into this, please summarize it for me, right? So now you're basically giving GPT or these other models, and you know, OpenAI with GPT isn't the only company out there with a large language model. But let's just assume that if you give these things proprietary information and you're asking it to sort of generate things based on a prompt, well, who are they securing all that information that you're providing as well? And I've seen people use GPT to summarize proprietary things inside their companies, whether it's emails or whether it's, you know, papers, reports, having it generate presentations, proprietary things like websites, et cetera. Who's securing that? And we've already seen in the last couple of weeks OpenAI had a security issue where, you know, security researchers were able to bypass its security controls, and they were able to, from a privacy perspective, see into other people's chat histories. So, you know, we're asking a lot here, obviously, of a company like OpenAI to produce these safe LLMs, but we are also asking them to be like every other company and respect the privacy and the sanctity of all this data. And then you get to the sort of third thing, which is going to be even more wild, is it's actually not very difficult, KB, to build a GPT. There's a very famous a very famous machine learning and AI researcher. His name is Andrei Karpovsky. You know, he worked at Tesla. He was a very, very famous and is a very famous machine learning expert. He actually went on a YouTube video and said, hey guys, I'm going to show you how to make a GPT. I'm going to show you how OpenAI makes ChatGPT. And in a YouTube video over 90 minutes, and I went through this process and other people I know did too, it's extremely lucid. It's extremely simple with the right set of tools and libraries for anyone to build their own GPT. And so the rumblings that I'm hearing now about in the security community is people who are taking this up to 11 and they're building their own GPTs, but instead of training it on the vast content of, you know, internet crawl data, which they don't need, they're training it on security data. They're training it on, you know, known exploits, known attack patterns, fuzzed payloads that actually bypass systems. And we will start to see the emergence of special purpose GPTs, not these sort of general purpose GPTs, but maybe even special purpose security minded GPTs that are designed to create novel attack payloads. So that's where this really goes up to 11 in my mind.
Okay, so there's definitely a lot going on. First and foremost, I want to explore a little bit more. You mentioned that people, you know, can copy paste IP from a company, and you said, how are people securing that information? So how are people securing that information, or they're not?
They're not today. And you know, I think we need to go back, and we're giving people in these companies these tools. There's a lot of companies that have now purchased GPT subscriptions or API keys for their teams and their companies, but they totally have neglected that there's a security part to this, which is you are giving these companies proprietary input, and people need to be trained. Maybe they need to be trained in terms of understanding that this is proprietary stuff. How should they be securely handling it? And do they trust other companies to have that information? And so it's a complete rethink on, you know, the boundaries of what is proprietary, what isn't, and then what is the usefulness of what GPT will accomplish vis-a-vis that proprietary information. It needs to be reconciled is the point.
So how do people handle that? So if someone's listening to this and they're like, okay, well, didn't think of that. Kunal's made a great point. Now I need to start investigating. Like, what can people start doing? Like, because at the end of the day, as we know, there's people sometimes do rogue things, whether we agree or disagree, but it does happen. And then there is that risk that someone could do that. How do you sort of handle that from an executive perspective?
Yeah, so a few things. One, if I've already been using GPT and if I'm slightly concerned, even remotely concerned, that in my company that people may have been providing it with proprietary information, the first thing I'm going to do is reach out to OpenAI and ask them to clear all the history that my company has created, or the history of everything that was created by the company. That's part one. Part two is I need to explain to everyone in the organization that I'm in. And, you know, we've talked about this internally as an example at Imburma. How do we train people to use these tools in a secure way? And so the old saying, right? With great power comes great responsibility. It's the same thing, which is, hey guys, we're giving you this tool as other tools in your toolkit to let you get your work done, and that can make you highly efficient. At the same time, we need to reconcile the fact that you can't necessarily give it a bunch of proprietary information, because we don't own that data and we don't even know how that data is being consumed. We don't know how that data is being used. I think it's still really fuzzy, KB, in terms of that input data of how that is going back in to train these large language models. I mean, there's an element that we didn't even talk about yet, which is reinforcement learning and reinforcement training. But how is the information that we're providing going back and retraining the large language model itself? And so I think we need to do a better job of explaining to people what's possible, what's not possible. And then I think we may even see and this is, you know, maybe something for entrepreneurs or other people who listen to you out there to even think about, is can you build these sort of trust and safety layers for large enterprises that sit between your team members and these large language models to filter out that proprietary information? So if someone in accounting, and I've seen this example before, I've actually seen this example live, of someone in an accounting team will provide a set of financial statements and say, hey, can you please summarize the key trends in these financial statements? You know, you'll have some sort of layer that will sit in between that'll say, no, we absolutely cannot have these financials for a private company go to this large language model because we have no idea how this is going to be used. So let's try and filter it out. So I think it's going to come down to human training. I think there'll be some development of tools and processes. And I think there's always the sort of right that we all have as individuals, as humans, and as companies to request, you know, a copy of all the data that we've created and generated on the system, but also request that that data be removed and taken down. But I think those are the more tactical things that we can do right now.
Yeah, that's excellent. So just to go back on part one around, you reach out to OpenAI, you're like, okay, remove the data, for example. Just say that happens, but then someone new starts. Jenny's like, oh, you know, couldn't be bothered thinking or using computational power to use ChatGPT to do it for me, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. She does it. How often should you be doing this? Like, how often do you have to keep auditing? Because, you know, you can tell people till they're blue in the face. I think that's an Australian term, or maybe it's global, that to you know, not do that, someone's going to do it. So how do you keep ensuring that you are going back to OpenAI to say, like, hey, we need to keep removing that data? Like, how do you keep doing that? And I guess that it's going to be, you know, opportunity costs. Like, is it daily? Is it monthly? But then it's like, if you're doing that daily, monthly, like, you have to pay for someone to constantly be doing that from a governance perspective, from an auditing perspective. So how does that all work?
Well, I think it's to your point, I think there's so much manual audit and, you know, potentially some automated audit that has to come into place. You know, when you think about this large language model, you know, and the reason why it's done this way right now is running a large language model is incredibly expensive. It's really, really difficult. I mean, there was a deal that was done between OpenAI and Microsoft in the billions and billions of dollars. And many of those billions of dollars went back to Microsoft, from Microsoft to OpenAI, back to Microsoft for Azure credits, because running this system is so inherently complex from a compute and a storage perspective. But I would say there's a few things. One, for companies that are seeing the preponderance now of these large language models, these GPTs that are coming up, it's interesting that there's so many cool, innovative things. The first thing that you probably want to understand is, you know, it's like supply chain risk. Is this a vendor that you want to work with? Is this a vendor that you trust? You know, I think most folks trust Microsoft to do the right thing. They trust, you know, Amazon, they trust Google, especially, you know, these three hyperscalers. They trust these three hyperscalers to do the right thing. And, you know, I think we need certainly much, much more transparency around that. And then I think, let's kind of zoom ahead, you know, a couple of years from now. I think over time, as we've seen, computation improves so quickly, it's not impossible to imagine these large language models and these GPTs running, you know, inside of your own corporate infrastructure or your own corporate environment. What I think will probably happen is there will be some acceptable use policies that are going to have to be created inside these companies. I think we're going to need to do a stronger job of demanding transparency reports from these LLMs and GPTs to better understand, how did the content get there? Who's accessing what? Who's asking what? What information purely exists? Can we audit that data? It's not too dissimilar, KB, from people who use Slack or messaging software, like corporate messaging software in their environment. It comes down to acceptable use, right? Over time, you have to audit and see, well, did someone actually share, you know, confidential binary data from their system to somebody else using Slack? Or did they use some proprietary messaging product to get that data out? You know, I think there's an element of that that we need to sort of sort out. And then last but not least, there will be generational leaps. I mean, we've gone from GPT 3 to 3.5 to 4 just on the OpenAI side very quickly. And, you know, in terms of increasing the parameter and the model sizes, that's kind of what's been going on now. But we've also seen some strides taken by other companies that are looking and thinking, well, maybe we could make this stuff more portable to live in people's environments. And so I think over time, you know, as these GPTs start to run more and more in our infrastructure and our corporate environment, well, then I think you could start to allow more of that sensitive information to be asked, especially knowing that you could ring fence that GPT to only run in my environment. And I'm certain for a fact that it is not exfiltrating or sending that data anywhere else.
So Kunal, do you trust OpenAI to do the right thing?
Oh, there it is. That's the question, huh? yes and no. So I trust that they've done an awesome job of building the model so far. I trust that they know how to build a great large language model. Right now, if you were to ask me, you know, gun to head, would I trust them from a security perspective today? The answer is no, I don't. I think they are still figuring it out. You know, what's fascinating and interesting to see, though, is that they've been very open about this. They've spoken at length in large interviews about how they don't even know how this stuff is going to be used. And it could theoretically be dangerous, and they're willing to learn along the way. When you have a tool that's this powerful, like GPT, I'm just concerned that taking that perspective and that attitude, while it's great for pushing technology forward and we can advance use cases for certain things, and I'm not against that at all. I think there's a lot of powerful and great use cases here. I think that operating model needs to be tightened a little bit more. I think as organizations using OpenAI, I think we all deserve to know from a security perspective how the data is being used, how the data is being collected, how we're arriving at specific, you know, answers. What is that trust and safety model? Can we inject our own trust and safety model into it? Right. Those are the types of questions that I certainly have. And so today, do I trust them from a computational, you know, AI machine learning perspective? Yes. Do I trust them from a security perspective? Well, no. And if you think about it, last week when they had that privacy gaffe where people could go into other people's chat histories and see what they were asking, that's scary, right? Because again, people are divulging sensitive, sometimes private, proprietary information in these prompts. And so I think there needs to be a broader rethink in terms of the overall operating security model here.
Yeah. And look, I know that's a hard question to ask, and it's more so just, you know, asking the questions that people are wanting to know. And that's sort of the purpose of behind I've developed the show in the first place. So you mentioned before, you know, the people behind OpenAI, like they don't even know what it could be used for. So the people that are working the company don't even know, which I kind of get because these things can spiral out of control. But then isn't that worrying? So if they don't know, how are we supposed to know?
The first question is, you know, if you could sit down with the OpenAI team and be like, did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams that someone like myself would be using GPT to generate a computer program that, you know, was based around my internal company proprietary requirements? They'd probably be like, no, we probably, maybe they did. Maybe they don't. Or if you could ask them, did you ever imagine that someone would generate, you know, security attack payloads that could circumvent security controls, you know, like firewalls? They'd probably say no to that as well. But at the same time, could you have imagined that this thing could be used to advance drug discovery? Or could you imagine that this thing could be used to find, you know, and sift through lots and lots of information to help people become more efficient at what they do? The answer could be yes. And so I think it's a delicate balance, right? And I think the sort of challenge here, KB, is not necessarily the open AIs of the world. Open AI is just too big now, right? There's too many large companies using them, licensing that information. Over time, I suspect that they will get to where we as, you know, individuals, as large enterprises will want them to go and where we want them to go. But what happens when you find the smaller companies that build their own GPTs that aren't subject to the same scrutiny that we are as larger organizations, larger companies? What happens when you get the smaller ones that take off all the rate limiters, take off the governors, take off that trust and safety layer? That's where it starts to get weird. You know what I mean? Much, much more weirder. OpenAI is just too big now, and there's so much scrutiny around it. And the team over there has said, yeah, if we see something bad, we will stop what we're doing and do a rethink. So at least they're being very, very intellectually honest about the fact that they don't know how it's going to be used. But they're also willing to say, yeah, we're willing to pull the cord to kind of, you know, suspend operations if we need to go and address or figure out, you know, how we make this thing better. that's not the big concern in my mind. The concern in my mind now is you get these smaller GPTs or these smaller large language models that get applied and used, and you know, they're not subject to the same scrutiny that OpenAI is. And so what happens when I've got people in the company that are going to these smaller vendors and providing them with proprietary information to get data out? And to your point that you asked earlier, how do we codify acceptable use? I don't think we know yet. To your point, I don't think we know how to codify that acceptable use. I don't think we know how to evaluate the supply chain risk of these AI, these generative AI vendors and solutions. And we have to figure it out, and we're going to have to get there very, very quickly, especially given the leaps that these technologies are making.
So when do you think we'll know?
Well, I think we're going to be forced to figure it out with OpenAI very, very soon. I can tell you that in discussions with very large companies who are using OpenAI over the last couple of weeks, given the whole privacy situation, many of them are now waking up and realizing, oh, it's great from an efficiency perspective, but do they even have the right security controls in place? So they're starting to pull back inside their companies now. I won't name names, but I can tell you, chatting with many CISOs or CISOs over the last couple of weeks, they're getting asked by their own boards, how are we using this from an efficiency perspective and is it secure? So boards are even asking these companies, is it secure to give it all this information? And so I think we'll arrive at something in 2023, certainly this calendar year, I think we'll arrive at a relatively loose framework for how we want to interact with these things. And I'm sure that just like other best security practices, CISOs and other organizations will just share, you know, what are some best practices, what worked for them, what didn't work for them from that perspective.
But don't you think as soon as we figure that out, something new will come along? Next OpenAI, the next thing, the next that, the next artificial intelligence platform, whatever it is, will come along. So it's like, it's this constant battle of trying to get a head above the water, which is exhausting.
Yeah. And you're right. There will be an element of cat and mouse for a while. And what I mean by that is if you think about the realm of application security, to kind of go back to a specific industry today, let's call it AppSec. In application security, for the longest time, it was attacker finds a novel attack that bypasses a firewall or network security, network and AppSec. Some attacker finds an attack payload, like a zero day or whatever it is, and they bypass the firewall and they get through and they run their exploit and, you know, problem happens. Well, company then has to come along and create a virtual patch and so forth and so on. And then it, over time, you know, when you sort of calcify that behavior over decades, you kind of have created that sort of, I think people just become either callous or they become so embedded into, okay, this is standard operating procedure, which is new attack payload comes out. There's no rules for it. Here's how I do a virtual patch. And now let's wait until the rule is created by the vendor. And oh, the rule can mutate or the attacker can pivot off of that attack. Therefore, let's go and get smarter about it and let's iterate. Over time, that kind of converges to a known behavior. And that's like the known cat and mouse game in traditional security models today. I think the part that's novel and new here is the fact that it's just a new medium for experimentation. It's a new medium for interaction. I think over time, we will get to that routine, that standard operating procedure that we have in traditional security will apply to AI. Because exactly to your point, we may build a model for how to work with OpenAI and how to work with OpenAI's GPT. To your point, what happens when there is company X that comes along now and company X releases product Y? And product Y has its own set of existential issues. So I think we're going to have to deal with it, and we'll have to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. I think if we try to take a very hard stance on it now, the concern is that as businesses, and you also see this argument from like a board perspective, as businesses, if we choose not to engage with these tools, how are we actually competing with companies who are in our industry, who are embracing these tools and are getting maximum efficiency, or they're creating these breakthrough products or features because they are willing to sort of go out there and use these things. And so it's going to be a balance, right? I don't think it's going to be, okay, guys, sorry, you can't use any of these AI capabilities or technologies. I certainly don't think that is a prudent way to go, because you will get lapped given how fast things are innovating. So putting on the CTO hat, I think you have to explore these technologies. And then putting on the CISO hat, I think we just need to build acceptable use policies. We need strong audit around this stuff. we need governance, really. We need governance around how people in these organizations are using these technologies. And then over time, as we start to see the emergence of other capabilities, we then need a framework around, well, how do you securely use these other things? And it's not too dissimilar from previous industries of where we all came from.
So you mentioned before that boards are starting to ask these questions, which is a good thing. But would you say that people are sort of scrambling because, I mean, there's so much stuff going on, right? Like, this is just one dimension of this field. There's other stuff that we still can't get right over many years. And now we're this thing's super powerful and it has the velocity and the veracity that's something I've never seen. So where do you think people sort of sit? Are they worried? Are people concerned? Are they panicked? Or what would you sort of say? Because things, like you said, you know, things are being deployed so fast now, like we can't even keep up. Like the people that created OpenAI don't even know what's going on in terms of how fast things can change.
Boards are looking at it from multiple perspectives. One is there's this sort of shameless thing that some companies have, which is, here is trending topic in technology or innovation that's trending. How are we part of that? And so there's one ask, which is the board saying, are we doing enough with it? Are we making enough noise that our company is leveraging, you know, these new capabilities for something so they can be in the news cycle? They can just be relevant, or that they are somehow part of the trend. And it's fair for everyone in these boards to bring it up. And yes, it happens to be somewhat of a frenzy right now within these boards, within the cyber committees of these boards, where everyone is talking about it, where everyone is saying, well, what happens over time? I mean, Gibby, we've been doing this long enough now, right? Where this isn't a straight line in terms of innovation. This is an exponential curve that we're on. We're looking at GPT-4 today. What happens as GPT gets stronger and you get to 5, 6, 7, whatever it might be? Who knows where we'll end the year up in terms of how advanced GPT from OpenAI will be, or how advanced other GPT or large language implementations will be several years from now. And today we're at a point where, you know, the payloads, the attacks and whatnot that are being generated today, when you can get these tools to deliver those. But what happens when these things kind of evolve and these things can produce, you know, really interesting attacks? What happens when, you know, today you can leverage machine learning and AI to look at a source code libraries, identify weaknesses that we're not finding already today using static analysis tools? And what happens when you can then identify those weaknesses using AI and then generate specific payloads or attacks that target those things? What happens when we get to that point? Well, you know, at some point we will have AI offensive systems, the same way that we have fuzzers and the same way that we've got existing tools today to find attacks. And therefore we will need something better from a defensive perspective to stop these types of issues. And either that better is a rethink of the model, going from like a negative security model, which is rules and signatures, to behavioral, which is considered a positive security model, which is, I understand the behavior of this thing. Or we then have to apply some sense of AI security defense system, right? Which is, okay, there's an offensive system. Do we have a system to go and detect that this is a payload generated by AI and it looks somewhat dodgy? Let's just drop it. And I kind of view it as, we've all seen the stories, I'm sure, of people who are using OpenAI to write college essays and people who are writing book reports and, you know, things based on OpenAI. And schools and universities, colleges, et cetera, they're all now tasked with trying to build tools with respect to trying to identify, is this OpenAI generated content? Is this, did AI write this or did the student write it? And so I think these detectors are going to emerge. And, you know, that's the part that boards are really curious about, is given the breakthroughs and how fast this is evolving, how do they need to think about their security posture? So I can tell you lots of cyber committees all over the world, not just in the United States, but all over the world, are beginning to have these discussions around, you can see a future of how AI can generate these attacks. How are we going to build defense systems to stop them? And again, it's not there today, but you can see the future. You don't need to be into science fiction to sort of imagine that possibility. You can see where this is all ramping and you can see where it's all going.
Yeah, well, this is a big topic. I think that, look, it's more so a conversation, and I don't expect anyone out there, you know, at the moment to have every single answer. It's too hard. It's very new. It's uncharted waters. So what do you sort of think moving forward then? Now, I know you've touched on it a lot, and I'm very appreciative of that. Like, you definitely know what you're talking about, which helps. But I know that you don't have a crystal ball, and you're not sitting there like looking into the future, but if you had to sort of give our audience sort of something based on, you know, your predictions or what you're seeing, like, what do you sort of think people can expect in the future, which may give them some sort of reassurance from your perspective?
I think there's so many interesting things to contemplate here. I would say that the future of technology and innovation is just incredible. You know, we are at the top right now, really the bottom of this curve, and the bottom of this curve that just kind of does this exponential leap for the next couple of years. And it's really interesting to see. We're going to be able to solve really hard, very difficult problems, whether it's in biology or life sciences, where we will learn how to, you know, leverage and create new types of medicines or treatments to solve for diseases that we as humans have. I think we're going to be able to solve really large problems. I think we'll be able to make some fundamental breakthroughs in science or in the sciences. Now, I think that that's a really powerful thing. I think that we will end up creating newer types of systems. I think we're just at that sort of beginning and early phases. We have no idea how people will use technology like this, but it's very clear that you can do some very interesting things with technology like this. At the same time, we have to always balance innovation and new technology with the fact that there are bad actors out there. So while we have these great intentions for using these technologies, and the best intentions went into building this technology, and I have no doubt in my mind that the team behind OpenAI had nothing but the best intentions when they built this. Totally fair. But what happens when you have something so powerful and something that's so capable of doing novel things out there for anyone to use and constitute? And I think that is the biggest thing and the biggest question right now is, how can people use this? There's going to be, as you just said, more use cases, more things that we just don't even know about. And as that stuff gets used, and as that stuff actually, you know, ultimately discovers new capabilities, new content, et cetera, I mean, there's going to be some pros in there, but there'll also be some cons in there. There'll also be people who use and abuse these things. And we're just going to have to learn. And so it's kind of like the early days of the internet. And, you know, not everybody who may be listening remembers what that period of life was, which was, you know, it was the Wild West. You didn't know what was going to happen. Things were changing and evolving so quickly. New types of internet technologies would come out. First, it was static content, then dynamic content. And then maybe there's folks here who remember things like ActiveX or Java applets, or maybe Macromedia with Flash, right? All of these things layered on and made the internet much, much, much more rich. And then, you know, you fast forwarded to where it is today, where we leverage the internet as a protocol, but look at the types of experiences that we have. And they're vast, right? They could be informational experiences of reading the news, or they could be virtual experiences today. And it's fascinating to see how far we've come. And you think about that over maybe a 20, 25 year, maybe even a 30 year cycle, right? Of what the modern internet looks like today. This is something similar to that, which is a brand new curve that we're going to see. And we are really just in the beginning phases, in the beginning days of it. As you just said, at the beginning of the year, at the end of last year, beginning of this year, that's when we started to see people really using GPT. This ChatGPT was really starting to be used at the beginning of the year by a lot of people, and it's already revved up a major version number. From the beginning of the year to now, we're only 3 months into the year. And what's crazy is you just think about that exponential growth curve, and you think about how fast these companies are evolving and operating. And, you know, I think we're just going to need to watch and learn, and we will make mistakes. I to be very clear, we are going to make mistakes. We don't know what the future holds. All we know is that it's going to move very quickly, and we're going to need to be able to respond very quickly to meet those challenges as they come up.
And just one last sort of comment. You mentioned beforehand when the internet came out. So probably the mindset back then was like, oh, this thing's really bad. And like technically, if we look back retrospectively over the last, I don't know, 30 years, yes, the internet is good. Like I can talk to you. We can, you know, do business from wherever now. And then there is the bad side of the internet, like, you know, the dark web and like all of these other things, like people that are, you know, trolling people online. Like there is good and bad. So do you think that it's like this new paradigm of open AI, it's sort of the same mindset that people had 30 years ago when the internet sort of started up? Do you think it's like that again? Or like, what do you sort of think?
Yeah. So there's a mental model that I subscribe to, and I wrap it around what's called Amara's Law. And Amara's Law is something really beautiful and really poignant. It's a short law, which is we tend to overestimate something in the short term and tend to underestimate that something in the long term. And you and I have seen this 20 of times in technology and security, which is we tend to overestimate in the short term the hype around a particular new fad, a new topic, a new industry, a new product, whatever that might be in the short term. And we think that that's the cure-all. We think that that is going to change the world and everybody needs to be adopting this now. And many of those things don't go anywhere, right? We overestimate that short-term capability or efficacy or some sort of net value, net result of that thing. But then we don't think about the long-term effects of, okay, if you have this thing out there and it compounds and it gets better over time, what does that actually look like in the long term? And we tend to underestimate a lot of these things. So I think, look, AI and OpenAI has been around for a very long time. I mean, minimum, you know, I think it was 2012, 2015, something around there, right? In that early 2010s era was when the company was formed and created. And they've been going at this for quite some time. And I remember when they first started going at this, people kind of rolled their eyes and they were like, yeah, AI, yeah, this just seems like a bunch of hype. Who knows if this will actually get to where it needs to be. But the firm just kept chugging along. And now you're starting to see, you know, almost 10 years later, here's what they can do. And here's what we can do as humanity 10 years later. And so I think going back to the question that you asked, you know, what I fundamentally believe is that we need to just have a healthy balance of understanding that things in the short term may appear much larger than they actually do in real life, because whether it's hype or whether it's marketing, whatever it is, that just sort of creates this initial snowball. But if we take a longer perspective, you know, if we operate with a shorter time preference, you know, which is, you know, thinking 10, 20, 30 years out, you know, there's a lot of good that can come from this. And yes, it does feel, in my mind, it does feel like the early days of the internet, which was, this is going to do everything. We're going to be able to solve for all these issues and all these things. Yeah. I mean, look, you're absolutely right. You and I can talk today using the internet. We can have this conversation, this lovely conversation using the internet. And maybe we conceived of having this conversation 30 years ago, but we didn't have the technology. We didn't have the tools. We didn't have, you know, infrastructure that could support that. And so I think there's an element of having the imagination of what could this be? What could this do? And then spending that time, spending that resource, those resources to sort of iterate on the bits, the software side, as well as the atoms, you know, the physical infrastructure, the hardware side. And then I think it's very clear to see that this is very disruptive. And I'm just so excited about the future and obviously reconciling it with the now and the security side. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited about the future as well. But there's also, you know, being a security practitioner by trade historically, there's always that mindset that kicks in. So it's always wonderful to have guests like yourself on the show, to, you know, to share your opinions and your knowledge and your insights. And, you know, there's no really a wrong answer. It's more so just having an open conversation to hear your thoughts, yeah. And so other people can learn from that. So Kunal, I have absolutely enjoyed this conversation. It's something I've wanted to talk about for a while. And I think you've really gone into extreme detail and you've given really tangible insights for people to take away, to start thinking about and to start implementing that. So for that, I'm super grateful for having you come on the show today and to hear your wonderful insights.
Baby, thank you so much. And again, I'm a huge fan and I've listened to many of your episodes. And what I love is that it's not just guests like myself, it's other folks who you talk to and how you try to really explore that intellectual honesty and how you really try to push and get to what people can do today. And I really appreciate you doing that. And I think we need more voices, specifically not just in cyber, but generally looking at seeking out the truth and seeking out exactly what is going on and how people can stay ahead. So thank you for doing what you do. And it's been a pleasure talking to you today. So thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to KBI.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.